The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly, the technology podcast that transports you to a whole new world. I'm Alex Krotowski, and today myself and my podmates are taking you on a trip into another dimension. The virtual dimension, that is. We've been to Edinburgh, we've been to Manchester, why not Azeroth or Second Life? Listeners of this podcast are likely familiar with these places and the concept of virtual worlds. The online communities, Second Life and World of Warcraft grabbed headlines in 2006 to 2007, astounding people with their feet firmly planted on the ground that there were people who wanted to spend more time in representations of reality than in its physical original. And while the headlines have stopped cawing quite so much, likely to change thanks to last week's arrival of Google's virtual world Lively, the virtual world landscape has continued to grow in acres and miles, spreading like a digital virus through almost every online interaction we have today. Joining me today to make sense of it all and to predict the virtual world future are two experts in this area, The Guardian's Vic Keegan and curator of Virtual Policy 08, Ren Reynolds, founder of the Virtual Policy Network, a writer, philosopher, and all-around great guy, aren't you?
I am.
Indeed. Well, welcome to you both. Vic, which virtual world is your creative tour de force?
I think I spend most time in Second Life, because although it's kind of gone a bit dead as far as new people coming in, it's still where everything is happening in terms of the laboratory.
What I find interesting, your relationship with Second Life, you use it very much as a creative outlet, as you say, a laboratory. I was wondering if you could tell me a bit about the types of things you do in there.
Yeah, well, I've built, with the assistance of somebody else, an art gallery. And we sort of put other people's art in that's created in Second Life, and also our own that arises from Second Life that you can only do in Second Life, i.e. using avatars and also using Photoshop images that you import and you can play around with them in Second Life, and virtual poems as well. It's a kind of space where anything virtual can be put in, and just to really as a laboratory.
Ren, you're a bit of a virtual world slut at your own admission. Which ones do you spend the most time in?
At the moment, I'm in Warcraft, Second Life, Twinity, Age of Conan, of course, which is the latest big one. MapleStory, which is one of the biggest in the world, but one that virtually nobody has heard of in the West. It's a Korean one.
Loads and loads there. And hopefully we'll pull on some more of that as we talk a little bit later. On today's show, we'll be ignoring the dramatic headlines about the real-world riches to be made in these spaces or the well-publicized depravity lurking under the pixelated bed clothing. Instead, we're looking at the very real ways virtual worlds are being integrated into the discussions and the decisions politicians, policymakers, and the legal system are making and having. Plus, we'll explore the implications of the growing number of virtual worlds environments aimed at kids under 11 years old. Plus, there will be the usual news and opinionated views, plus the hottest conversations going on in the virtual world blogosphere. Get ready to head into a whole new world. We're going virtual. It's a strangely futuristic scenario. A person breaks a law in an unreal land, steals a digital loaf of bread, for example, and is successfully prosecuted for theft in a real-life court. An online community executes a digital criminal, and government adds a statute to its records. Spaces like Second Life and World of Warcraft, two of the most popular virtual worlds around, overflow with human behavior, which government advisors, policymakers, sociologists, economists, and psychologists like myself are studying in order to understand the real-world implications of virtual activities. Inside these digital tabula rasas, people from around the world gather to form emergent communities with rules, governance, and policy. And this week in London, the brightest minds from policy, government, and academia across Europe have gathered to dissect where and how the lessons learned in virtual worlds can be applied to the very real statutes our countries operate within. Now, Ren, with regards to the Virtual Policy Network and Virtual Policy 08, can you tell me what it is?
The Virtual Policy Network is a think tank that I've recently formed to look at all the public policy implications of virtual worlds. What I wanted to do was bring together three stakeholder groups: academics, industry, and policymakers. And I wanted to do that on a global basis. The reason being that most virtual worlds can be accessed from around the globe. One of the differences between virtual worlds, or a lot of virtual worlds at least, and the internet, is that these are a lot more centralized. So you can't really get hold of the internet and govern it, but you can get hold of Second Life or World of Warcraft and govern it, because they're single spaces, single namespaces, to be technical about it.
But they're commercial spaces, so would this be different if the government had created a virtual world?
Oh, sure. But the difference being that as they're centralised, it's easier for government to apply rules to these things. So from the perspective of a policymaker, they can see a group of servers, a group of people doing things on those servers and think, that's something that I can regulate. The problem that we've got is that every nation in the world sees that and every nation thinks, oh, I'll regulate this. And we have big regulatory differences around the world. We can basically say that there are three groups. The US, of course, has a largely industry-based laissez-faire type regulatory system. In Europe, we tend to come from centralized statutory-based regulation. And in the East, there's a whole mixture, and it depends which type of thing that we're talking about. China has tended to be laxer than the West in terms of intellectual property regulation, although that's changing now.
Why regulate these spaces? I mean, what is it about them that needs to be regulated? Aren't they just blips on the internet radar?
Well, here's an example. I run this gallery, which is called Second Life Gallery. It's called SLART, SL for Second Life and Art for Gallery. A month or two ago, I had a legal letter from a hotshot New York lawyer saying, cease and desist, take this SLART down because we're running a magazine which is very similar and you are causing us material damage, blah, blah, blah. A very heavy letter. What should I do?
Well, if they're in America and you're in the UK, they probably have very little jurisdiction over you, so you could probably ignore it. This is one of the difficulties that we have with virtual spaces, that they destroy distance to some degree. Therefore, you are in some way local to people in America, and therefore Americans may think that US trademark law applies to you. But if you're purely a UK citizen, I'm not sure how legally the reach would get to you.
Most people do just think that these are spaces that are just blips on the radar, that they're not spaces that are of any concern. But there are certain rules that govern these spaces. There are certain isms that take over in these spaces. And I was wondering, Ren, if you could tell me a little bit about the types of rules that you think govern online spaces that are of interest to offline policymakers.
Well, there are rules at every level. I think if it proposes anything, the Virtual Policy Network is into what one might call multi-layered jurisdiction. So in a virtual space, you tend to be doing something with other people. And when any group of people get together, they tend to either consciously or unconsciously form rules. If you go to a restaurant, there's some rules of etiquette. Now, they sit within spaces where the spaces themselves have rules which are defined by the providers. So if it's a game, the providers may say how it's right and fair to play that game. And at the higher level, then there may be issues which actually do come into international law. So things like intellectual properties is the most obvious things here, because the digital objects in these spaces can have trademark implications and things like that. So that's not something that people sat around a restaurant table can usefully create their own rules and norms about. It's potentially something that a virtual world provider can create rules about, but generally speaking, it's something that governments would look at. So what we've got to do is look at each of the different issues and think about at what layer is it right to create and enforce norms.
Copyright rules vary between 90 years and 40 years, and trademarks are also different legislations that apply in different countries. Is it possible to do this without having the sort of global agreement that doesn't exist in the real world?
One of the interesting things about virtual worlds is they do draw attention to issues like the fact that we haven't got harmonized trademark law around the world. People then start immediately asking these questions. Many of them have been sitting there and underlying. And indeed, we do need an intergovernmental approaches. The critical thing is to work out, is it the role of governments to work out how loot should be equally divided in a World of Warcraft raid? Probably not. But who owns a trademark for World of Warcraft, and whether Machinima, which is then commercialized and played on MTV around the world, who owns the rights for that, possibly is something that governments should get involved in.
Ren, I'm wondering if you could detail if there are any policies that have come out of virtual worlds already.
Probably the most famous thing in terms of online currency is a QQ coin in China. That's a virtual world currency which became so large that it had potential to impact the Chinese yen. So the Chinese government ruled that it could be used for person-to-person transactions but could not be used for person-to-business transactions. In Thailand and I believe some other countries, they've brought in statutory regulations for play time. So servers have got to be shut down a certain time of day because they don't want their citizens becoming addicted and playing too much on these virtual worlds. There are a number of countries which have started to look at the tax implications of revenues generated from virtual worlds. So the US Joint Economic Committee has ruled that they are only interested in currency which is converted into hard currency and profit, though the Australian tax authorities have recently commented that there's no reason in principle why gains within a virtual world shouldn't be taxable.
So I lied then when I said that we weren't going to be talking about money in virtual worlds. Apologies. Vic, you've got one.
Well,
briefly.
One of the problems is that all of this legislation is disproportionately influenced by producer lobbies, like the copyright rules. It's not because the consumer wants copyright to be extended to 90 years. It's because a limited number of producers do, mainly in that case Walt Disney. Earlier this month, the European Union passed a three strikes and out law for internet service providers to enable them to get hold of people pirating music. Now, that was done entirely by producer lobbies. Now, when it comes to virtual worlds, if there's going to be legislation like this globally, the consumer's voice is going to be difficult to hear. And is it going to be done entirely by producer lobbies again?
Very possibly. I mean, companies like Disney now are moving into the virtual world space. Blizzard, that make World of Warcraft, are a huge company. Nexon from Korea, who make MapleStory, a huge company. So the people that own the lobbyists are pretty much the same kind of media conglomerates that you see pushing other types of legislation.
You think with the user base that virtual worlds have that a consumer movement could rise up within it, but there's no sign of it yet.
Well,
no.
The consumer base of music is much bigger than the consumer base of virtual worlds, but the consumer lobby has done very, very little in terms of digital rights.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure that as the consumer base of virtual worlds increases, then we'll see more of these issues brought forward. I'm sure many of these things are being discussed currently at Virtual Policy 08 happening in London this week. Now here's Jemima with the news.
Apple reported a 31% increase in annual profits last quarter, but the announcement was overshadowed by rumours about the health of chief executive Steve Jobs. Investors have begun to ask who will take over from Jobs, and Apple would only say that his health is a private matter. Yahoo has struck a deal with Carl Icahn that will see the dissident shareholder take one of three new seats on the Yahoo board. Current chief executive Jerry Yang is staying put, but the move is designed to defuse a likely proxy battle at next week's annual meeting. Eric Huggers was confirmed as the new BBC Director of Future Media and Technology. Replacing Ashley Highfield, Huggers has control over the BBC's £400 million annual technology budget. And B-Sky B is to launch a subscription digital music service by the end of the year. Universal Music is the first to sign up, with others under negotiation.
You can read all about these subjects, plus the latest technology news at guardian.co.uk/technology. Two years ago, at the height of the Second Life land rush, companies from Toyota to American Apparel to Calvin Klein and even The Guardian literally fell over themselves to establish presences in the virtual world, captivated by the idea that engaging with the product in a virtual world would translate into offline brand loyalty and a dramatic increase in bottom line. And indeed, research has demonstrated that product placement in online spaces, from viral videos to interactive games, does keep the attentions of an incredibly distracted, media-savvy consuming population. Now, since that time, the virtual world's landscape has boomed, and the most buoyant market has been those developed for kids. Kids under 11, who are likely to spend more time and in greater numbers in online worlds than their adult counterparts. The tipping point for many was when Club Penguin, a kids' virtual world with an emphasis on quickfire games, was purchased by Disney for $700 million in 2007. Over the past year, over 100 new environments specifically aimed at kids have broken digital ground. Kids' virtual worlds largely fall into two camps, the educational and the explicitly commercial. But recently, the BBC announced that it was getting in on the act. I spoke with Mark Goodchild, head of interactive and on-demand at BBC Children's, to ask which category their forthcoming title, Adventure Rock, fell into.
Adventure Rock is, we call it an MSOJ, a massively single-player online game. The best way to describe it is something Zelda-like. You go into the world and then you do a mixture of things, which is traditional gameplay, collecting cogs, working through levels, unlocking mysteries, unlocking areas. But also at the same time, in each new level that you unlock, there are these creative studios, an animation studio in a dance choreography area, which they then upload to the website, which sits outside the game. What's different about it, I suppose, from most games in this area, is that we're feeding the best of the crop each week back into the game. We patch it in so that throughout the environment when you're running through, there are plasma screens and you can see stuff that other kids have created that week.
We've just made a new discovery. Massive buildings all around the island. Some are much harder to get to than others, and each one has something different inside.
Turns out that there are actually studios where you can get creative and do all kinds of cool stuff, like drawing, animation, music and loads more.
And we've also found ways to send it back up to CBBC.
We create events in the world that we sort of do a brand takeover. So for instance, Smart, very much about traditional art drawing and sending in your pictures to the TV show. The new host of Smart, he's done a drawing, and he says, I'm now looking for a track to assign to this picture. And then we give the children a week to come up with their music. What we found is that there are some who are absolutely inspired and just want a forum or a place to go and show off their skills, but the majority tend to actually like a little bit of direction. And obviously, the thing that children these days congregate around are brands. They're far more brand savvy than we ever were. And so for us, it's about tying those two things together in an appropriate way. So Smart is about creative endeavors. Therefore, we tie that up to the drawing studio or the music studio. So it's not just sort of gratuitous use of brands to drawing kids. I think it is actually about what is it that that brand can inspire them to do.
But using brands in kids' virtual worlds isn't something Lisa Ray, founder of Parents for Ethical Marketing, agrees with. The Watchdog blog keeps an eye out for over-commercialization directed at children and is very concerned about the use of brands in kids' entertainment environments.
If kids are motivated by brands, it's part of a culture that's been created that says belonging to this brand makes you popular, or belonging to this brand makes you cool. It's not a natural association, and it goes back to that whole idea of manipulation to get them to eventually become customers.
At what point do you believe kids become the critical consumers of content?
Children are not able to understand the subtleties of commercials until they're probably around 12 years old. Even up until age 8, they aren't even at the point that they can recognize the difference between fantasy and reality. So anything that's advertised to them under the age of 8 or so, to me, seems to be unethical.
2 years ago, the kids' virtual world space was sparse. Now you can't move for tripping over a new one. Why? Well, I asked Michael Smith of Mind Candy, creators of the new kids' virtual world Moshi Monsters, what's inspired this digital land rush.
There's many, many sites in development. I think the Club Penguin deal was a real kind of turning point when Disney acquired them for up to $700 million, when people realized what a huge opportunity this was. Not only are kids spending a hell of a lot of time online, but crucially, parents are willing to pay and then able to monetize the sites. So, you know, everything from Habbo, which has been going many years, Neopets, and then more recent entrants such as BBC's Adventure Rock or Webkinz or slightly older virtual worlds like Small Worlds from New Zealand, which just launched the other day. It's a pretty busy space.
Welcome to Moshi Monsters, the world of adoptable pet monsters, where you can play games, get creative, and connect with friends. Visit the adoption center to choose your Moshi monster.
Why kids, though? I mean, this is the thing that I think causes the most concern about this space.
Kids are spending such a large amount of time online, and as mentioned with the Club Penguin deal, parents that are happy paying, so that there's a commercial model there. But obviously there are a lot of very important ethical issues to bear in mind. You know, we certainly don't want kids spending all hours of the day on their computer when they should be out doing other things, building dens and playing football and so forth. So for us, it's very much about building a property that we can create successfully commercially, but also fits in around the rest of a child's play life and all the other important things they have to do. And the other very important thing we wanted to do with Moshi is not just build an experience that is fun, but to do that and then on top of it, build an educational angle. So the monsters send kids puzzles every day, and there's a new word of the day that they learn, and the casual games that we're building around it will all have an educational component to them. So video games and virtual worlds can teach them everything from strategic thinking to how to formulate hypotheses to socializing with other people to figuring out how in-game economy works and so forth. So there's a lot of very valuable elements for kids spending time in these worlds.
And the BBC's Mark Goodchild agrees that there are benefits for kids in these spaces. With Adventure Rock, they're trying to encourage all kinds of learning, but at the same time are quick to stress that their world isn't motivated by capitalism.
Well, we don't have a very strong currency, although it might be stronger than the UK currency at the moment. You know, we collect cogs in our world, so it's not quite as capitalist as some of the other virtual worlds. I think there are worlds which are very much about currency, and wherever you've got currency, you have the sort of economic rules of the environment you're in. In Adventure Rock, you collect cogs to get new assets to dress your avatar. But there isn't a sense that certain T-shirts or something for your avatar cost more because it's a supply and demand economy. It's interesting, though, for me, there is very much a sense that actually one of the positives about virtual worlds, if they're managed correctly, is that this is probably the place where a lot of kids are now finding more about social norms and what's acceptable behavior than they do in the real world. So kids going on the bus, barging past an old lady getting off the bus, no one on the bus these days will speak up and say anything. But actually, you go into virtual worlds, there are all sorts of rules and regulations. You have to play by the rules of the community, and people either get booted off those communities or they lose their reputation because they don't play fair.
We asked Lisa to have a poke around a few new kids' virtual worlds on the market, and she and her daughter picked out their favorites. Michael Smith's Moshi Monsters got Lisa's daughter's seal of approval.
She thought that that was one of the better ones in that the advertising was less obvious to us. I mean, we had to dig to find the products that were available. I wouldn't call it educational. I mean, to say it's more educational than any other virtual world is kind of ridiculous because they have games that you have to use your mind in a different way. It doesn't really make it educational.
And you mentioned Club Penguin.
I had a really, really positive experience with that. There were actually moderators floating around in the chat rooms. You knew who they were. And the games were fun, and I was shocked to see no advertising in it, which really surprised me, of course, because it's owned by Disney, and I hope they keep it that way, but I was pretty pleased with that one.
But according to Lisa, other virtual worlds cross a dangerous and potentially unethical line.
One problem for me is product placement. They don't know they're being advertised to. I think it's unethical to ask kids to give their friends email addresses in order for that company to market to their friends. I think it's unethical to give kids points for filling out surveys. And also just to do anything that's going to try to influence a child's purchasing preferences just because they don't understand what's happening. So to me, just about any kind of advertising is unethical. So I'm not thrilled with it. I think anything that takes away from true creative play, from being outside and using your mind, and the way play was meant to be created naturally is how you learn to work out problems. I mean, that's what play is all about. And so to me, this is sort of an artificial way, but parents see it as a good substitute for TV.
That was Mark Goodchild from the BBC, Lisa Ray from Parents for Ethical Marketing, and Michael Smith from Mind Candy. Now, Vic, Lisa's concerns feel quite dramatic. You know, she's very concerned about this idea of advertising to kids, but how are virtual worlds advertisements any different from advertising to kids on television?
I don't think in essence they are, and especially where they're in a controlled environment like Their Two and Disney, where they're only allowing certain kinds of ads and certain kinds of material to go to be in front of the kids. There's a much greater danger when kids go into virtual worlds that are for both children and adults, and where there aren't such rules. And there are real problems that really haven't been experienced before, and we will have to tackle them because the influx of kids into virtual worlds is providing an expanding base, which will go on and making virtual worlds more and more popular as they get older. So I don't feel there's a desperate problem at the moment because they are controlled. But in these interim worlds where both mix, I think there is a problem.
Ren, is this somewhere for regulation then?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of issues. One of the differences in a virtual space is the amount of time of exposure to a brand. So with a TV commercial, you're only getting a few seconds. With a virtual world, with something like Disney, they're exposed to the Disney brand several hours every day. There's an underlying issue potentially as well, which is the data mining of the chat that's going on in these spaces. And really, whether there's informed consent, either on the parts of the kids or the adults who have signed them up for these worlds.
Is the Virtual Policy Network looking at all towards regulation or towards policy in this space?
The point of the think tank is really to to bring the groups together to try and discuss these things on a virtual basis. One of the projects we're looking at initiating at the moment is looking at children's developmental stages and the types of business models which are implied within virtual worlds.
I can see all the dangers in all this, especially of monitoring the behaviour of children in these worlds for advertising purposes. But, and again, this is happening against the background of this unprecedented outpouring of data that people of all ages seem prepared to do. And the more that there is, I suppose, the less easy it is to mine it in a way. So that there are potential problems, but they don't seem to be shared by the people who are actually participating. That makes it perhaps more difficult to make rules.
And they've also got to be made in the right context. With lots of things, especially to do with children, we have a thing often known as a substitution fallacy, and that is, if a kid wasn't doing this in a virtual world, they'd be outside in the green fields playing with sheep and lambs. Well, of course, they're not. They're kept off the streets, they're kept inside. So they can be a force for social good. So I think there has to be a degree of regulation, especially in, you know, what the companies are doing and how exactly they're using the information that's coming out of these spaces. But I don't think that's in terms of kind of banning them or shutting them down.
I'm afraid we're going to have to stop this conversation here. You can read more on this on guardian.co.uk/technology and keep up to the minute with information at blogs.guardian.co.uk/games. Speaking of blogs, this week's wee road trip into virtuality deserves its own blogs roundup. Vic, where do you go for your virtual worlds news?
Well, there are lots of them, but at the very top of the tree is the one that's so intellectual. It's in Latin, terra nova, new world. Not a bad word for it. And this week, Ren writes for it, of course. This week, I was intrigued by one blog by the cybersex correspondent for the Village Voice. Okay,
Bonnie Ruberg.
She's gone into Google Lively to see what there is on the sex front. And she says, having heard about liveliness. I was excited to settle in with the new world this past weekend. To my disappointment, despite trying a number of rooms and a number of chat partners, I could never get a proper session of cybersex going.
Oh,
and this is all to do with the way that the bubbles come up and the way that people speak different languages and everything else. So what can one say? Google may be taking over the data of the world, but it's making sex boring.
Well, I've got a comment about Lively, actually. It's equally as scathing, though perhaps not as blue. The ever-entertaining Cavalcade over on the Games blog says, and he's referring to the PlayStation 3's forthcoming virtual world space, Home. He says, nobody's excited about Home. It is, this is Cavalcade's opinion, not mine. It is a turd, a big, stinking, festering turd. But said that, I'm even more excited about it than yet another internet-based 3D virtual world. Lively looks awful. Everything about it is awful. I'm making a snap judgment that would cause Dennis Dyack to choke on his book collection, but this will last a few months at best until it finally, thankfully, dies a death. I've actually enjoyed playing around with Lively, though I haven't gone in for sex. But Ren, where do you go for your virtual world news? Anything you've picked up on the blogosphere?
The news over the last week has been, someone described this as like a moon landing, a movement of an avatar from Second Life to OpenSim. So that's the open source version of Second Life. Somebody moved an avatar from one to the other. Sounds like a piece of data integration to me rather than the moon landing. One of the things with virtual worlds is they are all separate islands, and it's very, very difficult to communicate between them and across them. Now, I'm not sure that moving an avatar from one to the other is the right way to go. I'm more into kind of integration of social networks. But the fact that people are actually looking at this is an interesting thing.
Thank you, Ren. You can find those links on the website, which is guardian.co.uk/technology. Now, in our quest to catch the Google Street View car, we've had some feedback. We've got photo proof. It exists. David Hassel has posted up photos of the nefarious Big Brother machine in Deansgate on the 15th of July. So you can head to our Flickr group, Guardian Tech Weekly, for a peek. Also, this in from the I Love the Guardians Tech Weekly podcast Facebook group. Groupie Simon Hancock says, I was walking through Clifton Village in Bristol this lunchtime listening to the podcast about the Google car when it drove past and caught me. I was listening to the podcast on my phone Walkman, so I couldn't switch the phone to camera mode fast enough to get a picture. So if anyone looks at Regent Street, Clifton, Bristol, and sees someone with a grey sweatshirt, that's me. So check him out. And Mark Chester says, also on the Facebook group, I'm holding out for the Google car catching Jemima in her pants as promised. So keep your clothes on, Jemima. You've got company. No grand prizes yet for catching the Google peeping Tom without his kit on, so keep searching and do let us know how you get on.
In this Thursday's tech section with The Guardian, We speak to Evan Williams and Jack Dorsey, founders and growers of Twitter, in their first newspaper interview since they bought the search engine Surmise. Despite an excited report suggesting computers could run on DNA sometime soon, we find there's no chance it'll happen. We hear from ergonomists who aren't convinced touchscreens are such a good idea. And we hear how a mobile operator has been cold calling customers offering insurance against a warning that Bluetooth hackers are about and will take over their phones and run up huge bills. We review three Skype phones, discuss location-based services, and look at alternative reality games. This and more in Thursday's tech section with The Guardian.
That's it for our little traverse into the fascinating, unreal worlds of virtuality. Next week, we'll be hearing from games bloggers Greg Howson and Keith Stewart about what went on at Develop, the UK's biggest gaming conference. Many thanks to our guests this week, Lisa Ray, Mark Goodchild, and Michael Smith. And of course, many thanks go to Ren Reynolds and Vic Keegan for joining me in the studio. I'm Alex Kratosky. See you next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.